causal dynamical triangulation, in particular the idea to rephrase or find a new framework for causal dynamical triangulations using concepts from information theory. So I work together with my collaborators on these topics. All three of them are based within on the field of quantum information, condensed matter physics. So let me first, so this project is not about really taking a particular proposal about quantum gravity and advancing it further. It is just to take a particular model of quantum gravity, a particular simple model of quantum gravity, and see if we can actually find some analog system for that. So let me just briefly like say which analog gravity proposal I'm considering here. And so the general problem, if you, as all of you know, probably much better than me, if you want to quantize gravity, you run into all these difficulties. Two proposals to resolve that issues are, on the one hand, working with continuum theories, but adding some extra terms to the gravitational actions, such as asymptotic freedom or Horava-Lifshitz gravity. On the other side, you could say, can I perhaps use some lattice regularization techniques? And in particular, one very successful candidate is causal dynamical triangulations. So it's a discrete quantum gravity theory candidate. And recently also, there has been connections, which I find quite interesting, to see the question is, what is the continuum theory of this particular discrete quantum gravity candidate, these causal dynamical triangulations, and there have been connection between, or proposed as there is a connection between Horava-Lifshitz gravity and these causal dynamical triangulations. So I'm not explaining much about this connection, but I just wanted to mention it. And in particular, we're working on this side, and we try to find a way of reducing space-time literally to bits. So I will give a very brief summary just in case maybe there's somebody from condensed matter for all the people working in or quantum information or other fields. The people working on quantum gravity, that's a very poor man's summary of CDT. It's also not that important because I will explain some details basically on our new framework in more detail. So the idea behind discrete quantum gravity in a nutshell is that if you have a Lorentzian manifold, it allows or it admits a triangulation into a net of simplices. So what is a simplex? A zero simplex is a point, a one simplex is a line, two simplex is a triangle, and so forth. It's just a generalization of a triangle in higher and higher dimensions. So, and of course, because this is not, in a sense, I would say a discretization as if you do numerics, you use finite element methods or so. This really is, you're looking now for a discrete symplectic analogs of curvature and so forth, and which is also referred to as the Ricci calculus. And curvature in particular is evaluated at the vertices and evaluated with deficit angles. I will explain that a little bit better in a minute. So this is discrete quantum gravity, and from there there was a continuation of this discrete quantum gravity is what's called causal dynamical triangulation. And the difference being that within causal dynamical triangulation, the edge lengths of these fundamenting building blocks of your simplices, of your triangles, for example, in two dimensions, the edge length is fixed. So, and that's one of the modifications. The other modifications is it's an ad hoc reduction of the configuration space. And that can be very easily understood in for gravity in 1 plus 1 dimensions. So if I'm looking at triangulations, so here I have two kinds of triangulations. The difference being between these two is that the one on the right has a foliation. And so in principle, if I would draw all possible triangulations in 1 plus 1 dimensions, I would get both of them. So behind causal dynamical triangulations, there's the idea that you only sum over those which have this foliation. The hope is, or maybe I should say the hope was, I would say that this foliation goes away in the continuum limit, but there are very strong evidences that it actually persists, which then also relates this theory, causal dynamical triangulation, and suggests that a possible continuum theory of the continuum limit could be, for example, Horava-Lipschitz gravity. So these are all side remarks and not so important for this presentation. So you only sum over those geometries. So how does this work? So you can actually get a pretty good hands-on picture of this. So let me first, I said before, explain a little bit about curvature. So in a flat space time, said already something wrong? Yeah.
No, I just had a question. You said that you weren't going to concentrate on it, but you, as a side remark, you said there's growing evidence that the foliation persists.
I would say the spectral dimension, because.
Can you just briefly indicate where it's coming from?
So I would say if you look at the spectral dimensions, for example, the spectral dimension should go at small diffusion times, diffusion steps. It should actually go into the spatial. You should pick up D plus one, for example, like the spatial dimension. But what you see goes below. And this going below seems to already be there in the continuum. So the question, there are also ideas to connect it to asymptotic safety and so on, but already I have an observable. And when I go to higher energy, to shorter diffusion times, I see that something different happens as expected from GR. So I would say, given that that's one of the few observables we have, I would say that's a good indication that it's not quite GR. But I might be, this is just a personal opinion about that.
No, that's an interesting question. But in the, maybe to say that the spectral dimension, I think it's mostly measured inside a given phase, which is this extended phase, where you get the extended universe. And so what's numerically quite difficult is to go through the phase transition, and then there's even an endpoint to this phase transition line. So there's one proposal which is that you might get Lorentz invariants, or you might get, not for Java, but GR on this endpoint. That's a point which is numerically very hard.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm not sure if everybody heard that, but what Bianca was saying is a very good point, that the idea is that you have different phases, and maybe there is one particular point which is hard to reach numerically, where you would really get GR, and in other points in the phase space, this might relate to Horava-Lipschitz gravity. So, absolutely right. You cannot say from there's not enough evidence or has been enough done simulation that one really can say you cannot get GR. And there are fantastic ideas. Renate Loll works on that, where she partially gives up on this foliation. And she still tries to get full GR coming out of that. So it's just for me, I would say at the moment, it's clearly not certain that we get GR. So we did some works, and we did data fitting. We took Horava-Lipschitz gravity, calculated the calculated the spectral dimension, how it behaves in the UV. Then we took the data in 2+1 from Dario Benedetti and Johansson, and we did a curve fitting to see if it works. And you got a pretty good match. Now then, Frank Sauer-Essig and Reuter, I don't know the first name actually. So. Martin Reuter, they looked at asymptotic safety and did some similar things. And they also said, we're also getting a pretty good fit. So it's up. I think it's a very important and interesting question. I think it has not been answered fully yet. So again, I don't want to scare off anybody not working on quantum gravity. It has nothing to do with the rest of my presentation. So just what's the difference between flat? When do I have a triangulation that represents, for example, a flat spacetime, and how does curvature come into the game? So what you're seeing here, this is a triangulation. These dashed lines just indicate, I'm assuming, periodic boundary conditions. So I'm on a cylinder, really. And what you can see, if you have you cannot see it so much, but if you have six edges going into one vertex, that corresponds to a flat geometry. Now, if you have a curved one, then this number varies. So this is how you basically evaluate curvature, and in some sense, it's piecewise flat, and all the curvature is evaluated or hides at the vertices. So, and how, what are you doing then? So if you, for example, run these Monte Carlo simulations, I mean, one of the nice features about that is beyond 1 plus 1, you can actually do something in C plus 1 dimensions, and you can do that on a laptop. And what you can do, you can run these Monte Carlo simulations where you would generate representatives of this configuration space. So in theory, you should sum over unique representatives of these triangulations. So you have to find the equivalence classes, and you sum over all of them, and the weight of them is basically a discretized version of Einstein action. So the Boltzmann factor here would simply be general relativity, or in this case, Ricci calculus, the discretized version of that. And you would sum over this, and this is how you evaluate the path integral. So what you have to do, in principle, you have to sum over these unique triangulations for all numbers of triangles. But in CDT, there is a restriction on that, and in a sense, you sum over a fixed number of triangles, and that corresponds, is equivalent as if you were adding a cosmological constant, which would then single out or favor a certain amount of triangles or simplices in more general. So this is all very, very general. It's not so much to do. So let me just move on and talk about this new framework, which also helps one to understand these very abstract concepts in much more hands-on way. So the first thing is, the idea was CDT is very simple. So this is not about, is that really the quantum gravity proposal? It's just an idea to say this is a very simple candidate for quantum gravity. So in fact, it seems, at least in 1 plus 1, where I also have to add, and this is a big critic always, that it has to be solved analytically, can be solved analytically. So it's very well understood. So let me take, I would say, perhaps the simplest candidate for quantum gravity in 1 plus 1 dimensions, and say, can I find another system or something else which would be analog to that, which has the same characteristics? So then this analog system, right, might be useful in many ways. It's just a new way, a new framework. Maybe it gives us some deeper understanding or different insights rather than the standard chain framework of CDT. And also somehow it relates CDT to a physical system. And then I would say, okay, I was sure that you can actually identify such an analogy, but there is an open problem which has nothing so much to do with our framework. It has to do with CDT in general. And that's something which made me think that perhaps it's not so important to find these analogs. Maybe you have to address a more important question first. And that is, suppose you have such a system. Suppose I can set up a tabletop experiment and everything is fine, everybody is ready, and then there comes a big question. What are you going to do with this? What is the effect you're looking for which you want to maybe simulate in an experiment, in an analog simulation? And so I think this is one of the problems which in many quantum gravity proposals exists. It's hard to find physical consequences. So for example, Bianca was talking about the vacuum state, and someone in the audience asked, so what if I start with a different vacuum state? Will there be a physical consequence of that? And ultimately, what we are looking for are physical consequences of quantum gravity. So I will come back to that, but basically, having completely demotivated my whole presentation, let me now go through the details and how you could find such a system. So the first thing is space-time. CDT is a space-time, a fluctuating, a dynamical lattice. So when you think of a real system, a real-life system, that's very hard to consider. So let's set up the problem in a different way. So let's say I replace a dynamical lattice, a triangulation, with a fixed lattice, and encode the triangulations in the degrees of freedom sitting on lattice side. So now, fact, turns out that really the simplest degrees of freedom, simply a 0 and a 1, is sufficient to encode these triangulations. Now, of course, 0s and 1 can encode anything, so you also need some rules, which additional rules should you have to apply in. But in this sense, the configuration space is just 2 degrees of freedom, 0 or 1, for example. Now, what we did then is we said, OK, it turns out up to boundary condition, CDT in 1 plus 1 dimensions, is so simple that you only need one building block. One building block to construct the whole triangulation. And we call this a fork. Obviously, if you look at that, a fork consists of one vertex, 3 edges, and if you want to, you can associate 2 surfaces to this. So you put the edges, wherever there's a 1, you put a fork. And then there are simple rules which you can evaluate, starting from any given fork. You don't have to start in a particular way. And the rules are just simply given with associated to these 3 edges. And the way it works, let's focus on the red edge. It connects to the neighbor on the top on the left. And then you're left with 2 edges. You say the blue one is just connecting to the left. And then you're left with the bottom one. It just goes to the first one down or to the left. So if you do this, what you end up is a planar graph with a foliation. And then, of course, you can, if you like, you can now say, OK, this is my foliated triangulation, where here runs time and here goes space. OK, so now there are certain questions, really, which are that looks nice, but you have to really show, for example, questions, can I encode all triangulations? How big has the lattice has to be so that I can encode all possible triangulations up to a certain number of triangles, for example? So simply. So this is this analogy. So in some sense, from this bit array, you can construct a triangulation. And if you separately store these rules, how you generate this triangulation, you could save the whole information of this triangulation in one simple unit of information. Okay. The number of triangles is super easy because the number of triangles is just twice times the, if you sum up over all the ones, times twice, because every fork has 2 triangles. So, and the ones tells me there is a fork. And then you have it. So it's really simple. Okay. Now these are the questions which I want to answer. And I think there is actually something nice in that because we can prove something very simple. So which is related to CDT. So in CDT, you can start from a triangulation, and you can apply what's called Pachner moves, and you can generate every other triangulation starting from your initial configuration applying these Pachner moves. I think it has not been shown that if you're on a foliated triangulation, start on a foliated triangulation, apply the Pachner move, that you will end up, that you can generate all of them. I'm not quite sure, but there's a very easy way, a trivial way, in this new encoding, in this new framework, to prove that. But is it, I don't know, I mean, so it's shown that this. No, I mean, not in the code, but from a mathematical viewpoint. Not in a code. This is an analytic way of showing this. But, you know, I mean, okay, fine, okay. So then I just said there is yet another way of showing the ergodicity. So, okay, so there are 3 open questions. Can any foliated triangulation can be encoded in a bit array? So the ergodicity of the bit array encoding. And if the binary encoding is ergodic, what is the maximum lattice size, as I already said, needed to encode all triangulations with n spatial slices of a certain volume? How big does my lattice has to be? And then another question is now, what about the degeneracies in my encoding? Can I learn something about it? Is there perhaps a discrete equivalent of diffeomorphism symmetry? Turns out there is such a thing. And then can we find this information can we use this information analogs once we established that, once we understood the configuration space within our new encoding, can I throw away completely geometry, this triangulations? Can I just work with that and just work with zeros or ones without going back and drawing these triangulations? Can I evaluate all the quantities right there? Because otherwise, it's pretty useless, right? Because it's just another step. So the answer to all of this is yes, you can do that. And the way it's doing is the dual of this bit array encoding is an integer string encoding, which I will also explain. OK, so let's get first. Let me start again with here saying, so I start from a flat in 1+1 dimension, triangulated manifold flat space-time geometry. So at the moment, the boundary conditions are a little bit, I left it open so far. What I'm assuming is closed boundary condition on the spatial slices and also this way, also on the time. It's not necessary to do that, but for now I will focus on that. I will also explain why you can have one building block to do this, why it's possible. There's a mathematical argument why it has to be possible. So if I look at this triangulation, and now I can, there are two partner moves in 1+1 dimensions. So what are these partner moves? The partner moves are you take two triangles and you just flip the diagonal. So for example, if I were to focus on this here, and I flip the diagonal, I get something like that. And the other rule is, so this is number conserving, rule one. Rule two is actually, you would, if you have two triangles like that, you can, if you wish, if you apply this rule, you add another two edges in here. And basically, you added two triangles to the configuration. So this enhances the number of triangles in here. So but by doing this, it is not, I mean, you can actually, the idea is you can generate arbitrary starting, perhaps starting from a flat space-time, flat triangulation, you can generate this general curved triangulations. So now what can we do? So how can we, first of all, the goal is to show that every triangulation can be encoded in a bit array. And to show that is a little bit, seems like it's a little bit overdone. I tried to do it and explain it in terms of a picture. Let me explain what we've done. So first you take this triangulation and you draw the dual graph. It's a bit weird because I use different colors, but you see here these white lines and all the color lines just show you the dual graph of this triangulation. So what you can do now, you can, because you have this foliation, you can just imagine if I were to just pull on this string and turn it flat, I could actually map that simply onto this structure. And now what I can do, I can map that onto a one-dimensional object. And what you can do is now, the way to do it seems a little bit naive how we do it, but there is some mathematics behind. But you just pull that down, and you start pulling it down one by one, till you come to the point when you realize now, if I were to pull them off on this side, I have two choices, either here or here. And it turns out, when you look at that, it doesn't matter. There's a symmetry. If I, from this, go back to that and draw the triangulation, I will end up in the same, irregardlessly if I first have the red one or first the green one. So they don't care. And this already gives you the hint of the discrete equivalent of the diffeomorphism symmetry. So you can do that. And then you have this string here where you can do the mapping. Here I have the different color codings, which tells me on which spatial slice they're corresponding here, which one of the slices they were crossing. And now I can associate to the colors. It's hard to do some math with colors, so let's associate numbers to that. And now I can say, OK, what are the symmetries which I used here? And one thing which is what I've said before, behind the symmetry operation, there was the idea, if I have two of these integers which have a bigger distance than one, then actually I can commute them. There's this commutation symmetry of this kind. So if I have an integer string like that, and I look at the 1 and the 3, I can turn the 3 and the 1 around. And this would not add, would not change the triangulation behind that. So I have this symmetry, then I have cyclic permutations, my closed boundary condition, I also have these mirror operations. So these are all the symmetry operations which I can apply to my integer encoding. Now, one last step, what I want to do is I want to, from the initial triangulation, the goal is to actually get to the bit encoding, to the binary encoding of my triangulation. That's the final goal in some sense here. And what you can do is you can actually, if you have a string like that, an integer string, you apply, in order to make it simpler, there's no unique way of doing that. But what you can do is you use your symmetry operations to order it as much as possible. For example, if I see somewhere that I have, I try to really make it in consecutive tuples here, I try to order it as much as possible using my symmetry operations. For example, here I can move this, I can, this 3, 5, 1, I can turn this into 5, 1, 3, 2, 1. So I kind of like, if you look at it, just to order it as much as possible. Then if you have done that, what you can do, you can now look at this string, and you can say, whenever there's a number missing, like here I go from 1 to 3, I have to add in a 0. So I basically fill in all the gaps and just put the 0. And then I can decompose that again onto, I know the number of spatial slices in my original triangulation, because that's the maximum number in this string. So I then cut this off and put this together in this way. Now I replace every number with a 1, and where there's 0 is a 0. And if you then, from this, go back and put wherever there's a 1, a fork, where 0 is nothing, you apply the rules, you will see this corresponds to the original triangulation. So in some sense, every triangulation can be encoded in a bit array. Every foliated triangulation. So now, and this basically is almost a proof for the partner moves, because you could say, wait a second, let me find in analogs of the partner moves in this new framework. So what would be the analog of rule 1 and rule 2? And that's then pretty simple, because if you look at rule 1, you can, for example, say, how can I, for example, encode this? I start from a flat geometry, encode it here, and you see flat, of course, is completely irregular, numbers going from 1 to 7. And then how can I apply on this, my equivalent, my analog partner moves here in my new encoding to get to that? And you can show that's, of course, possible. And rule 1 is simply this diagonal is, you, if you have 2 here, you just flip it. And what that means, before, remember, if you had like 2, 3, I couldn't, there was this commutation symmetry which wouldn't allow it to flip 2 consecutive numbers. But now I can, this is basically rule 1. And rule 2 is just adding another number to my string. So clearly this proves that you can generate all possible strings with these two rules. And it shows the ergodicity of the partner moves. So you can also show how then applying rule 1 and 2 consecutive, how you come from this to that in this new framework. So what have we done? Let me quickly say that. So you have your binary encoding. Sorry? I cannot hear you. Yeah, you can do that as well. Sure. It's, you have, there's a way, I didn't, if you go back, there's a certain way of how applying rule 2. You have to be within in the way you're reducing it. I didn't explain it so much in detail, but yes, you can. So, okay, so let's just try to wrap this up a bit. So what we really have shown here, what I've shown here is any bit array I can map onto a triangulation. By using this other encoding here, I can go back to, I can go from any triangulation to a bit array. So now what this actually means is, if you want to, I think this is a nicer picture of understanding. So if I have a triangulation, I have a dual triangulation. So in some sense, what you can do if you have a bit array, and you look at the dual of that, it's actually this integer string. You can compactify that in this framework further. So the dual graph is very simple, really. So now, why? So if you think of system like that, you ask, okay, wait a second. I want to have all triangulation up to a certain number of triangles, which would be, the, in this case, a two volume. And what? How many? How big does my lattice size have to be in order to do that? And this is very simple. You can explain that very simply with the step when you say, if I have an integer string, and in order to map it on a lattice, whenever there is not a complete tuple, I have to add zeros. And each tuple gives me a column in my lattice. The number of rows are fixed because the number of spatial slices is fixed, but the columns are free. So it's once you think a little bit about it, you realize that I have to add the most zeros if I assume that I have to have at least one fork, one integer of every kind. So if I have it up to 7, I have to have at least every number once, and all the remaining forks I put in one particular number. And if you then extend that, you can easily show that you have the lattice size has already to be of the size n. And then if I say, okay, I have each one of them here, I have f forks. So f forks is 2 times the number of triangles. And then the number of columns is given by f minus n minus 1. So because I have here, these are the forks in a different one, in a different, these are the different integers. So I have all left crossing this spatial slice. Here, for example, I'm choosing 4. And then each one of them requires a own tuple, fills its own tuple. And this gives me then the number of columns in my triangulation. OK, so that's not too bad. And now comes an interesting question, which is, what about the degeneracies? So I now have these different encodings, and I can try to see how efficient they are. Because in some sense, what I want to do when I evaluate the path integral, or when I do the sum, the statistical sum, the easiest way to do it would be if I had one representative of each triangulation. Because then I wouldn't need to worry about it if I sum twice over the same. And what you can see is that this binary encoding is very degenerate. And in fact, you can keep degeneracy just as you wish if you make the lattice size very large. So if the lattice size was be infinite, doesn't matter how curved your thing is, you still would curved your triangulation is, you would have infinitely many copies of them. So this is, in some sense, that shows you that the degeneracies here can be a little bit better understood. And to give you one example, this is a flat geometry where I have a 4x3 lattice, but what I'm doing, I only have 9 forks to distribute on that. If I look at the integer string, I can use, because when I do the encoding, I would lose this missing here. I'm not putting forks on here. I would lose it. I would see what the integer string is. And then I could look at all these different configurations here. And you can see they look different, but in fact, they're all the same if you look at the integer string. Because on the integer string, I can apply my symmetry rules, and I simply find out they're just the same. So. I want to come to this. What maybe we can discuss it as well. So. There's also maybe something I want to discuss with you because you understand it much better. But it seems to me already, if I can, I have 2 encodings now. Now, I know how they are related, right? I would say the one is a dual of the other in some sense because the one is derived from the dual triangulation while the binary is from the triangulation itself. Now, I can say, well, one thing which is quite funny is that the degeneracies are very different. In fact, in the integer string, if you give me 2 integer strings, it won't take me, okay, if they're infinitely long, it's difficult, but it won't take me long to find out if they correspond to the same triangulation. If you give me 2 binary encodings, it's very hard to say if they're the same. See, I mean, for example, if I look at this here and this, initially you will probably say, oh, they don't look the same. If I look at this string, it takes you a few seconds to realize they're the same. So the degeneracies are, in some sense, are chosen with encoding. So in some sense, by choosing a particular encoding, I think, in my opinion, it's like choosing a little bit of a gate. And I think so. Yeah. Yeah. And in some sense, to be honest, if I know it's perhaps not what you want, but if you ask anyone who you would talk to some Conant's matter person and you would say, oh, I would like to find a Conant's matter system to do it, some lattice gas model maybe, or some Ising system, whatever, we'll discuss that in a second. And you would mention this problem about the degeneracies, it will be a little bit of a headache, because when you do something with it, you have to make sure you only count over each one once. So in fact, it would be nice if you could completely fix a gauge that only have equivalence classes. So that would be beautiful. So in the integer string, you could imagine when you write down the system, and because you have the symmetry operation, perhaps you could even do that. So, and I think this is something nice. I mean, it's nice because it makes this clear. It is a different, and I think, I believe, I remember the first talk I heard about that by Renate. She said, the shape of the triangles doesn't matter. So in some sense, encoding doesn't really matter so much. And I think this should be this way. I think it should be this way. It's just an encoding of the configuration space. So now the last thing is, as I said, this is pretty useless if all you can do is that, but every time you actually practically want to do something, I have again, not literally, but in some sense, draw my triangulations and do everything there. So what do you want to, what do you need to do? In some sense, you also want to get the Ricci scala out of that. And there are, if you're in this binary encoding or in encodings, there are simplest ways to do it simply by looking at the neighbors around. If I want to calculate the Ricci curvature here, I need to look at the neighbors. I need to apply simple addition rules. First, you sum along these lines, as I said, write down these numbers. And then if I want to say, OK, what on this fork, what is actually the Ricci scala here? Then there's another summation up to the next one, which basically tells you at the end how many edges are incident in on this vertex here. So you can do everything very easily with simple computations, without actually looking at the triangulation anymore. So and now comes the thing which also explains why it's working in 1+1 dimension, why it has to work in 1+1 dimension, which is, I think is quite, I have to be honest, we did not find it this way. But once you've done it, you realized it made sense because of the following. So why can you have a single building block generating the whole triangulation? And that is because, so the action in 1+1 dimension, the discretized version and the CDT version of the Ricci calculus takes a very simple form. But here is this psi, which is the Euler characteristic, which I will come back to in a second. And this N2 is the number of triangles. So the number, as Bianca asked before, and I think that's why she asked, how easy is it to get the number of triangles? So in the binary encoding, it's just the number of ones times 2. In the string encoding, it's the same, just a number of all numbers, just the length of the integer string, times 2. So it's very simple to get this N2. What about the Euler characteristic? Well, coming back to this thing about the boundary condition, why do I keep close boundary condition on the spatial slice and on the time direction? And that's very simple because then I can build it completely with forks. I don't have any boundary conditions, open boundaries, or where I cannot just have a fork, where I have some broken forks. So if I have closed boundary condition, I can completely build it out of forks. So the Euler characteristic of the whole triangulation, if it has closed boundary conditions, has to be 0. Now, if I build it out of n forks, so clearly every fork has to have Euler characteristic 0. And that's basically, I would say, the explanation for it, because a single fork has one vertex, N1 It's the number of edges, 3, and has 2 faces. So it has the Euler characteristic 0. So n times 0 is 0. So, and this is why, if you have closed bound, because of this feature, this geometrical feature, it's kind of like a justification why you only require one building block. And this building block has to have the Euler characteristic 0. And then you could sit down, perhaps there are more, but you have to make sure that this is given. Otherwise, you could not do it. It has to be consistent. It doesn't mean it only works then. It's just if you assume that, then you know it has to have a building block with Euler characteristic 0. That's just. You don't have to, it's just a simplification to explain things. But in principle, you can do everything. It's nothing new. It's just a different way of looking at it. So you should be able to do everything else as well. So in some sense, there's nothing new and no restriction to what was there before. Okay, so as I said, in initial, I haven't done much. But I wanted to say why initially I was interested in this approach. So again, which I think is what, to be honest, I'm coming from a very different direction as most of you here. Most of you here are very rigorous. You want to find the full quantum gravity theory and exact models, like, which capture everything. I want to do something else. I want to say, how much can I fudge it and get away with it? And it still has to share some feature with some quantum gravity proposal. So that's my idea, because what I want to do is, I want to forget about CDT, and I want to map it onto a real-life system. So one of the problems which I have when I put this Boltzmann factor here, I still have this thing here, this factor here, which says, which basically contains information that if I have 3 triangulations of the same kind, I have to, when I sum it, each one gets a factor of a third. So, and this is very hard if I look at the binary encoding, this is a really hard problem to figure out. So if I could do some operation, drive a system through some continuum limit, somehow I would have to encode this information. Or another way of phrasing it, which might be, how much actually can I get away with it if I'm not very accurate in this? What if I sum a few of them twice? How much of the degeneracies would I have to take out that I still get something that looks the same? So I would like to see, and perhaps, how robust these things are. How exactly do I have to evaluate this statistical sum? So now let me give you, and this is almost at the end. It's just like, so now you could ask, OK, can I use this thing to get some answers, like some trivial answers, which are far from actually working with this, but what are all the possible triangulations with 5 forks, so 10 triangulations, distributed on 3 spatial slices? What are the numbers that is the unique representative class? And what you can do, you know, I have 5 forks, and I want to have all of them. So if I have 3 spatial slices, I need at least 3, so from 3 to 5. And I can see what are my unique representatives. And with the string pictures, you just use the symmetry operation to single them out. This will be your representatives. Already that can become computationally very hard, of course. And then you can say, OK, how do they look like? And then you can say, OK, well, how does it in the binary? You can use your binary encoding to draw this. This would be the representative class of all this triangulation, up to 5 forks, 10 triangles. And now we come to the conclusion. So as I said initially, I haven't really done much. It's 1 plus 1. It's a nice idea. But for me, the problem is not so much 1 plus 1. One could ask, how difficult is it to extend it to higher dimensions? Already this example with the Euler characteristic tells you, you need to have more than one building block. And what's going to be very hard to do, we tried, is because on you have a foliation in the time direction, but not in the spatial direction. So you need to find a way of having non-foliated planar, if you would just take a slice through it and look at the spatial slice, it's not foliated in the spatial direction, along the spatial direction. That's very hard to find something like that. Really? Okay, maybe we should talk about that, because then it's easy, actually. You could, then that can be done. That could be done. Okay, but let me before, so I got a bit, so let me first summarize a few things and then say what I thought would be the application. And then I want to tell you what my problem is with what we have done. So I have this analog system, I would say, like it looks very different from CDT. Right, I can really an information analog in 1+1 dimensions. And now you could think of like having this formalism, you could think of a formulation of space times in terms of statistical mechanical model, models. It's now possible, for example, these lattice gas models. Then you could say, okay, one thing which I think was quite nice here, that the encoding, right? I mean, I call this the one Renatus and Jans, I would call it the simplicial encoding. That's just the CDT framework. But then we just found alternatives for that. And you could see that depending on which encoding you pick, you choose your degeneracy. So it's really an encoding. It's this gauge, this discrete equivalent of diffeomorphism invariance. And partially, by choosing a particular encoding, you partially fix the gate. What I would say would be an amazing thing to have if I had a system which is completely gauge fixed. So every spin flip, anything that's happening, is a unique triangulation. That would make it really easily accessible for any computation, for everything. It would be beautiful, right? Question is if such a thing exists. And the ergodicity, I think it's kind of funny, because you went through this framework, and suddenly Pachner moves ergodic is just there like this. So I think some things, when you choose the encoding, some things just become... Some things are easier, not all of them, but some things appear easier. So why? So why did we do this? Because we have not really addressed any physics question. This is just kind of like playing. And yesterday I asked Raphael, why are you doing this? Where is this going? And in some sense, I'm glad what he said. He said, it's just the beginning, but there might be an application. So in this sense, it's the same kind of spirit. So the hope was initially that well, you know, in some sense, I want to sum. This is a big configuration space, as you've seen already before with these five forks. So it was like it's growing really rapidly. And what you can imagine, I could sort of have a quantum representation here in a sense that I have a superposition of all the configuration space at once, right? Of course, there is much missing here because I need to still implement all these things I address, like the degeneracies and how you do the sum and so forth. But in principle, by bringing into such a framework, there are possibilities, things you maybe can go ahead and say, what about doing something like that on a quantum computer? Maybe you can find a very efficient algorithm to evaluate these things beyond 1+1, if you had that, which because in 1+1 it's solved anyway, where you can actually probe a bigger configuration space. And for me, because this is where I'm coming from, I would like to do, I don't like so much computer simulations. I think I am excited about the idea of setting out and carrying out analog simulations. So can you really find a real life system where roughly everything works and I can test some of the robustness features, right? It's not exactly the same, and I want to see how much do I get away with, and I still get something interesting. Problem is interesting. So that's my problem. So the problem I have, and which kind of stopped me a little bit working on that, is that, well, suppose you continue and continue and you put some more work in and you find some really nice system. And then you go to someone, experimentalist, and you say, you know, I have this crazy idea, you could do this and this and that. And then he would ask you, so what do you want to see? And that's, I think, is the question, because usually when you do something like this, there's some sort of crazy effect. Like you can see the analog of Hawking radiation in a fluid flow. It's a crazy effect if you think about it, right? It's an amazing, it's a scattering effect where when you look at the partners, it seems like the one which falls into the black hole enters a scattering process in a way that it has negative energy. So it seems like it's sourcing the whole scattering process. And you can get more out as comes in. And hence, you get this amplification of the quantum vacuum. And you get this nice thermal radiation coming out of the black hole. And through this process, the black hole can lose its mass. And I would say this is a cool effect. And in quantum mechanics, there's things like, you know, the particle wave duality and generativity. You have, of course, black holes and all these things. And the question is, what will be the cool effect you're looking for here? Why would you do all this? And I think I'm just saying that, in some sense, that is a problem. I mean, quantum gravity is supposed to be the next revolution in physics. There ought to be. I cannot give up on this idea. There ought to be some sort of really amazing physics happening. So, and I would say that what I'm missing in all the quantum gravity proposals is something like that. And if someone comes now and says, well, for example, in new quantum cosmology, you would resolve the Big Bang, I would say you almost took out the coolest thing. And you resolved it in a way that instead of having a Big Bang, you have a big bounce. Again, you're not probing really quantum gravity. You get an effective field theory. So perhaps we can continue to discuss this further. But I would say the problem of analog quantum gravity simulation, at the moment I see it, is also in the absence of anything cool to detect or to simulate. Thank you very much.
Yes and no, or something, because the no is, if you had been so demanding, we'd never have general relativity, because those things that you pointed to came well after the theory was already in place. Right? I mean, black holes weren't understood until, I don't know exactly when, 20 years, or so anyway, some significant time after the theory was formulated. And of course, black hole evaporation, long after we had both quantum field theory and general relativity. On the other hand, yes, maybe, because there's at least one effect, which is, I think many people point to, which is the cosmological constant. If this can tell us something about the cosmological constant that nothing else can, that would be, in the modern terminology, a cool effect.
Right. No, I understand what I said was a very,
so
for my own, very opinionated in a way, right?
Yeah, so there are indications for the fluctuations of the cosmological constant, it's a quantum gravity effect. So if you can make that rigorous, or if you can handle that effect, show it's either there or not there in a more fully formulated theory and quantify it, that's a goal you could be pointed towards.
Maybe I could add that this 2D CDT system is it's actually too special to draw your general conclusions.
No, but and, I agree, but what about higher dimensions? So what would be a cool thing to
make? Let me just continue on to this. So the amazing thing about the system was that it was the first example where in 2D you could get a reasonable 2D space-time statistically. So basically the question would then be, in the analog system, what kind of phase does it correspond to? And indeed, it might not be looking extremely interesting from the physics of this analog system. Maybe it does, because I'm not completely sure how it would like, if it would be really a block of ones or some regular structure, like just, Manhattan's nice picture, these black dots, you know. I'm not sure what this.
Lattice class model for.
Yeah, the kind of looked like Ising model, whether it would.
There's a similarity between lattice class.
How would basically the CDT phase and 2D look like in this picture? What is the parameter which you have to choose here?
In fact, I found this really interesting in your talk, because you were saying, okay, we're using this to look for different vacuum and so on, and looking for new faces and so on. I understand. This actually made me think.
So from this, and I don't think that it might happen that this CDT phase, which in itself in a quantum gravity interpretation was a big achievement to see that. It's not so amazing if you look at it in the condensed matter system, because it might be just one of the three phases or whatever that exists there. and it's well known there. So, so basically, but you know, there might be also, if you go into more detail, there are some special effects which might happen, and these are the claims that, you know, you get some periodicity, for instance, automatically in some sense. So these are more deeply questions, which I'm not sure how much interesting they are from the physics of the analog system. So that's a question. I think it's more, yeah, it's more important to settle these questions you asked before, because what we are doing is to map between two different combinatorial systems. And it's always very subtle if you have, whether you have a one-to-one mapping or not, because that changes the measure, basically, and how much that matters.
Right.
So basically the question is to make first sure that actually you can draw conclusions from your analog system, you know, or to which degree you can make conclusions from your analog system. But yeah, so that's...
Let me also say, this was not the critics really on CDP. It was just the critics of like, this, not the approach. I mean, the thing we've done is fine, but what I was hoping for, I don't see how directly to do it, but, you know, maybe, you know, what Bianca said is the right thing. Look for faces, look for other. I'm just saying right now, it's not the critics on the quantum gravity proposal. It's the critics of, we need things like that? If, I mean, the question is, would it be good, would it be nice to have this analog? But then for me, it would be, these are only useful. There would not be the whole thing. It would just have share some similarities. But then within this, there has to be a physics effect. There has to be something to be learned. So I'm criticizing myself, more like my own approach.
Maybe the problem is that here in 2D, the CDT system, you can solve it analytically. And so from this point of view, in 3D, it's not the case. And if you say you could maybe do it with this additionally sliced structure, that or it's easier to do simulations, that would be very nice if it maps to something more well-known, because so far numerically this additional slicing structure has not been implemented, and it was supposed to consider black holes.
Okay, maybe we should discuss it a bit further, because I think if you have another slicing on the spatial slice, I think you can do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually quite, you know, Dario tried to solve it at some point analytically. It was a lot of work. But there are so far no numerical simulations done, because the claim is it's even harder to do that, this additional slicing, this formulation. So if it's a newer formulation, easier, and that's usually the advantage of all these combinatorial mappings, that would be great. Physics-wise, yeah, and if there's even an analog system, it could basically replace the numerical simulations. That would be interesting, but it's really indeed the question to figure out this, whether it's one-to-one or whether it matters, to which degree.
That can be done. Thank you.
So have you done simulations with this? I mean, one thing that you could do, I think you were almost hinting at it, is just ignore this degeneracy issue and just treat, you know, each bit string as equally likely. And then, have you done that?
No.
What kind?
I haven't done. I mean, this is one of the things which I was thinking of. Maybe it's the next.
Seems like that might be the next thing.
Right. To just check. I mean, you have to find.
Because
slowly, you can start with a bit array and say, I don't think the bit array will work, and then maybe you could. Simple operation could remove some redundancies. Some, maybe you could see when you get close, if you can get close, or if it's really completely.
I mean, it's not obvious what you really want to do, I think. I mean, the whole point of, I mean, as you pointed out, the action of 2D gravity is essentially trivial. It's a topological term, and it's a something that just depends on the total volume, so just the total number of triangles. So if you hold those fixed, then you have the action is zero, in effect. It's a constant anyway. It doesn't influence, doesn't favor any particular triangulation over any other particular triangle. So all the physical action is really in the measure. It's in the redundancy.
Yeah.
You want to count the number.
In some sense, you're just counting the number of ways of making a particular.
The number of configurations, maybe fixing some things.
Yes, you maybe just fix. Intuitively, you're taking a particular two metric and you're saying, how many different ways can I represent it by a foliated triangulation? And that's, you're waiting for that, two geometry. So you, in a sense, you, what you've done is you've just introduced a particular measure for doing the path integral over all two geometries. But there's no one knows for sure that that's the right measure. It's just a choice of measure. By representing it in your way, you've just introduced a different measure. I mean, granted, maybe it's a little bit more natural, the CDT one. The most natural one is just the DTs, right, with no C in front of it. That would be the most obvious one. That didn't so far work out too well, although I guess people are still trying it. But the CDTs is a different measure, and yours is a different measure. So you could even end up getting better results than CDTs, for example. And I think one just doesn't know. Since we don't have any a priori argument telling us what the appropriate measure is, it's more of a trial and error. So that, I mean, that's why I think it's worth going and doing the next step and seeing what comes up.
Could you make some arguments to estimate the degree of redundancy of each physically distinct configuration? Because you have an algorithm to go from a ordered integer string to the triangulation, right? And you can do it in several different ways. So be able to assign a way, at least an approximate way, to each physical configuration.
One thing I would not just need to look in an old email of mine, because in Spain, remember Bianca actually solved it for the bit array. She just sent me an email and said, this is, you have to sum, this is the sum. But then I wrote back, but then you didn't take care of the degenerate. So I just need to go back, look at this email. So I mean, the bit array, I think it's straightforward, right? Because you know I have a certain size. It's a bit difficult because you choose a lattice, right? And what I said before, you have all triangulations for, let's say, 10 forks, or 10 triangles, 20 triangles. But then you also have more of them of a higher one. So you have a weird cutoff. You're not cutting off like in CDT people do, where they fix a total volume. I kind of have a cutoff somewhere. So that is a bit weird. But of course, you know, I mean, because you have like number of lattice size times 2, the volume, right? And so you know it's 0 and 1, so you know how many different binary structures you get, and then the question is...
Yeah, so you could actually solve the system.
Yeah, I think you have done it anyway.
Simulations.
I see. So what's the answer?
I have to look at this email, because I just...
Apparently I solved it at some point. In this case it was something easy, because it just... Binomial.
Right, it's binomial.
So because it's just a distribution of 1s over 0s, so it's just...
So what does solving it mean? Found a partition function exactly?
Yeah, basically counts the number of configuration fixing some values, which I forgot what are the values.
To be honest, I mean, right here, email, when I saw what you did, I stopped and just said, did it change? Because I thought this has not, it's a very different system, so I didn't even carefully enough read through the...
I don't really remember what.
We can look at this email.
You've been Spain too, you should remember.
Anything else? Yeah. Okay. So let's thank Silke again.